Nighttime on Still Waters. This is NB506812, narrowcasting into the night from somewhere on Britain's waterways.
First of December, Friday. Short sections of the canal are covered in a frosted skim of ice. Wafer thin, but firm enough to bear a moorhen's weight. She walks parallel to the offside bank. Left foot raised in a high arc, then place it flat upon the ice. Slide it forward half an inch or so. Pivot. Right foot raised in a high arc. Then place it flatly upon the ice. Slide it forward half an inch or so. Pivot. And so on. This is how to adapt when your environment is suddenly changed beyond recognition. Skating slowly, with an assured deliberation. The canal is still your home. It's a viciously inhospitable night tonight. As the sun fell, the temperature dipped to 2 degrees below zero. But now, low cloud has descended, wrapping us in a blanket of penetrating cold. Freezing fog. It flows in a stream of silver droplets on a northerly breeze in the beam of my torchlight. It's a night to be beside the fire. And this is the narrowboat Erica, narrowcasting into a frozen and fog-bound darkness of a December night, to you, wherever you are. But outside, any lights left shining are shrouded, each a dim halo, glowing palely in the raw cold. It's lovely to see you on such a wicked night. It's too nasty to stand outside, so make your way down the stern steps. Find a place next to the stove. The kettle is on. The welcome is warm. Welcome aboard. I'm particularly pleased that you could make it this week for this special episode. For this week, Dad had his 95th birthday and I've been thinking about the best way to celebrate it. We tend to be rather laid back in our family and never really go in for parties and things like that, but I did want to do something to mark it, particularly as he's not been feeling his best recently. It's nothing serious, but sometimes it's those annoying coughs and snuffles that can get you down the most. So I wanted to do something that would bring a bit of light and warmth up there on the edges of the cold Norfolk marshes. We were up there last weekend, hence no podcast, and I can assure you that it was very cold and wild. So what I thought, Dad, was that I want to take you back to a time when you were young, and the world, although still filled with its challenges and its complexities, was young to you. We're going to come with you, back to the time, to share in the moment that you and Mum met for the first time, and through Mum's eyes, listen again to her recollections of those months that eventually led up to your wedding. And next week, I want to read out about your honeymoon on the Norfolk Broads, a watery and boaty theme that I think fits rather nicely with this podcast. However, before I begin, I want to share with you, Dad, all the many greetings and birthday wishes that I've received to pass on to you from listeners to this podcast from all across the globe. So these are for you, and they're all wishing you a very happy birthday. First of all, our old friend of the show from Massachusetts, MJ, with Rory and Kayla. And much closer to home, Jackie and Pete from the narrowboat, the Lena Kelly. and Captain Arlo from all the way from New Jersey, and Amanda and Matt Keynes, who also think that you look ridiculously young, and Dana Reed from Thunder Bay, and Kathy Simpson, and Jeff Taylor, who's over actually in your neck of the woods, Dad, and Doug East, who says that at 80, seeing folks like you reach such a grand age can give him some hope, and Kaz Sargent, and Sherry Rauch from Massachusetts, and Tracy Thomas, and Pauline from the narrowboat Silconia, and Julia Shutt from the old Bethel days, Dad, and who loves your style. And I've posted a picture of you from last Christmas wearing your smoking jacket, hence all the comments about how dashing you look. And there's birthday greetings from Kirsty, who's actually an old student of mine, and she sends you her best wishes. And the narrowboat nomads, who think you're very dapper. And actually the word dapper came up a number of times in the comments about that photograph. And there's greetings from Jason Polite from Arkansas, and Sarah Breadlady from Louisiana, and LJ and Bodie and Catherine Friesen, and Trudy Kinlock from the old King's Langley days. And Trudy's mum used to work in Mansbridge's, the baker's, on the High Street. And Trudy made a very special impression on mum when mum worked at the junior school as a dinner lady. And Cheryl Davis, and I'm really glad that you enjoyed the readings from mum's account on the life in the Cathy, and I hope that you're going to be enjoying this episode too, Sherry. And Rita Hee from over in Denmark, and Claire Vincent, and Linda Olsford, who I'm pretty sure came to visit you with us back in the day, and Penelope Compton. Penny's mother and father, Joan and Don Carter, will be mentioned a little bit later on in this episode. They became really good and lifelong friends of the family and were frequent visitors to the Cathy. And I'm sure Don or Joan was a godparent to either Wendy or me. And there's also greetings from Anna Vaughan from Australia and Arlene Visa Kettering from Seattle, or it may be California at the moment. And they both also mention how dapper you are looking in that picture, Dad. And Deb Moon Mountford sends her birthday wishes and notes how distinguished you are looking and can't believe that you're 95. And Tony Rutherford from Kentucky, who sends best wishes and he loves your hat. And there's also one more rather special greeting, because I know how much you look forward each Friday evening to the Mindful Narrowboat vlog by Vanessa Thomas. Well, I have here a very special birthday message from her to you.
Hi, Meek. This is Vanessa from the Mindful Narrowboat wishing you a wonderful 95th birthday. I've seen photos of you on social media. I've learned all about you from listening to the podcast, and you are an inspiration to us all. If I can have just an ounce of your youthfulness and pizzazz by the time I'm 95, then I will be a very, very happy lady indeed. But I've written you a little poem, Mick, because it's your birthday, and it's called What Is It? Tell Us, Mick. Norfolk has a special draw. It must have magic air. Some butterflies and birds that soar over its broads are rare. Wild orchids make the grass unique, but the roads are special too, for sometimes on them, looking chic, you'll spot an NSU. Its rider fills your heart with awe, and off he'll knock your socks, for who do you know plus 94 that can wind and work the locks, yet still looks so unfrazzled? I'd love to know his trick. Take in the roads less travelled. What is it? Tell us, Mick. Happy birthday, Mick. Have a lovely day, and hopefully I'll get to meet you one day soon. Take care. Bye.
Isn't that brilliant? Thank you, Vanessa, and happy birthday again, Dad. And before I go on, I just want to say thank you to all our Lockwheelers for supporting this podcast. And you can find more information on Lockwheeling by clicking on the link in the program notes below. And they are Alison on the Narrowboat Mucker, Derek and Pauline Watts, Anna V, Sean James Cameron, Orange Cookie, Donna Kelly, Mary Keane, Tony Rutherford, Arabella Holtzapfel, Rory with MJ and Kayla, the Narrowboat Precious Jed, Linda Reynolds Birkins, Richard Noble, Carol Ferguson, Tracy Thomas, Mark and Tricia Stowe, and Madeline Smith. Thank you. An abiding memory that I have of Mum and Dad, and one that I think epitomises their relationship and life together, is from the summer of 2014. At the time, they were both in their mid-80s, and they'd come with us on a visit a little further up the North Norfolk coast to Old Hunstanton Beach. It's a favourite beach of mine, wide, sandy beaches that at low tide stretch to the horizon, and huge skies, and piling soft sanded dunes embroidered with tufts of tough marram grass spikes, and the smell of sun-warmed conifers. After we had a little walk together, Mum and Dad suggested that Donna and I go off and give Penny a good run on the sand while they rested in the sunshine. We later returned to the dunes with one tired but happy dog, and at first we couldn't find them, and I thought that they might have taken themselves back to the little cafe that's there. But then Donna spotted them, lying together, holding hands, fast asleep among the sand dunes in the sun. And it's a relationship that had started over 60 years earlier. However, we need to go back a little earlier than that to set the scene. And we join Mum at the beginning of the 1950s. She was in her early 20s, and she had partially left home and was working in human resources at Nestle's. It was a role that she really loved, and it seems from her descriptions of it a far cry from the modern, more desk-bound HR of today. And she's also at that time completing an extramural degree level program on social science and social psychology at London University that was run from an old school building near St. James Tube Station. And although Mum used to commute back to her parents' house in Rickmansworth at the weekends, during the week, she was living in Diggs in a hostel run by the YWCA. And it was a time where she formed some very close friendships with others staying at the hostel, which lasted all through her life. In many ways, this time of independence seemed to have acted as her university years, a time when she could cut the strings that held her to her younger life and grow into the person that she would become. And we start her story at the point where she was about to buy her first car, a very unusual thing for a young woman, or any woman, at that time. Mum had passed her driving test earlier, but had done very little driving since then, apart from when one of her friends, Joan Hay, suggested that she might borrow her Austin 7 to help her out with some of her work, which involved driving. It wasn't a complete success. Mum wrote about it. I went out with Joan for a trial run in her car, but I was horribly disappointed. Her car, the Austin 7, was nothing like those that I had been driving. One thing that terrified me was that the steering wheel had to be turned several times before the front wheels reacted. Joan was very used to it, but I found it impossible to drive. So, very sadly, I had to give up the idea. However, as we're about to see, cars, or a very particular car, Joe, was to become a central feature in the next stage of Mum's life, and in many ways, appropriately, was instrumental in Mum meeting Dad. Oh, and just one more thing. I know that generally today we refer to the company as Nestle, but in Mum's time, it was always referred to as Nestle's, and she always referred to and talked about it as being when she was at Nestle's. So I'm going to keep with that older pronunciation. After I'd been at Nestle's for about 6 months, I found that I was getting very tired, and in spite of eating as much chocolate as I wanted, the throwouts, of course, I lost a stone in weight. The difficult journey was the cause of the trouble. There were two ways I could get to Hayes. The one I usually took was by bus, Uxbridge, and then changed to another for Hayes. The other route was by train to Harrow-in-the-Hill. This might mean, depending on the train I caught, a change at Moor Park, and then by bus through Harrow-on-the-Hill to Hayes. Either way, it took a very long time with a lot of waiting between the changes, and on the weeks as I started at 8 o'clock in the morning, it meant an extremely early start to the day. Also, the evening I worked late meant that I was well after 11 o'clock before I arrived home. And there was still the one evening a week up in London for my lectures. I was now taking the final year. So Pa suggested that I bought a car. He would help me out with the money, and I would pay him back gradually over the next few months. And so, through a friend, I became the proud owner of Joe, a 1938 Hillman Minx. The body was in pretty poor shape, but the engine, I was told, was very reliable, and that proved to be true. And it was a great thrill the day I brought Joe home. I called him Joe because of his blue paintwork was of many hues, to which I added later. Joe with the many-coloured coat. Roy Brown, the boy who got hold of Joe for me, delivered it to the door, and it was with some apprehension the first time I went out in it. In fact, for the first few weeks, I only drove at weekends, and there were some Saturday mornings that, if I was not careful, I would find some reason for not getting the car out at all. We had a wooden garage at home into which Joe fitted nicely, but to get out onto the main road needed very careful driving. There was a short driveway which consisted of two wheel tracks of cement paving stones, and if one slipped off these, especially in the winter, then one was liable to squelch away in the mud that quickly developed in wet weather. Then there was a sharp incline out through the gates and over the pavement out onto the road. And one had to accelerate just at the wrong time, as far as I was concerned, fearful of anyone passing by. But gradually my confidence returned. Mama was very good and came out with me. Perhaps not being a driver herself helped her. During that time of trial and error, I knocked the gateposts down, and one time, when trying to manoeuvre the car out of the mud that I was floundering in, I found myself on the front lawn under the drawing-room window. Roger, my brother, told me later that he was told by Mama not to say anything that might upset me, as I was doing my best. How patient and forgiving were my folk. At last there came the day when I felt strong enough to cope with the journey to Hayes. I decided to do it on the day that I did the 2 till 10 shift, as I felt that there would be less traffic to cope with, and, as it was summertime, it would still be light for my homeward journey. The journey was about 15 miles, through Denham, Uxbridge, Hillingdon, and finally Hayes. After a trouble-free trip, I arrived at work jubilant, but I remember that my mouth was as dry as a bone with the tension, and the journey home hung over me like a black cloud. The one trip was quite enough for one day, but I coped, and after the initial fear, my confidence grew, and I got to love driving so much that even after being at work all day and having driven 30 miles, if the evening was nice, I'd go out for a drive around the country lanes. It was still a rarity for a woman to be a car owner, and because of that it caused quite a stir, and in some cases, especially in the factory, I had to put up with some very tart comments. But I loved old Joe, so I took little notice of them. And the only time I found driving a worry was on my trip home on a Friday night, when all the factories closed down at the same time. In those days, most factory workers cycled to work, and the main road through Hayes narrowed into a bridge as it went over the railway line. And as thousands of cyclists merged together, I had to be very careful as I drove amongst them, not to touch any one of them. And some of the youngsters took a delight in getting as close to the car as possible. If I had so much as brushed one of them, there would have been a nasty scene. and I loved driving home at night after my late turn. Joe had a sunshine roof, which, in good weather, was permanently open, and I often felt that I could carry on driving for miles. One night, I stopped in Hillingdon to get some petrol, as I was waiting to be served, so another motorist came over to talk to me about Joe. He had apparently owned a Hillman Minx the same as mine before the war. But before we could chat for very long, the petrol attendant stood between us, assuming that I was being troubled by the chap. Very nice to be looked after like that, even if a bit embarrassing. One day I sailed into work and parked the car in the last space available, just by our staircase, not realizing that it was empty because it was in fact the emergency exit for the factory. A little later, one of the security men came up and asked me to move it. I felt terrible. I felt that I, of all people, should have noticed. So I hurried down and, in my anxiety, put the car into gear instead of reverse and promptly bumped into the factory wall. Praying that no one was looking, I hastily backed out and parked Joe in the main car park. Later, when I was getting ready to drive home, I realized that my bump into the factory wall had pushed my bumper up, covering the hole into which I needed to put the starting handle. In cold weather, I needed to start Joe that way. So that meant that I had to stand on the bumper to try and get it back into its rightful position. Luckily, someone came to my aid, and between us, we managed to restore the bumper to the right place. When Joan and I found that we both had some leave that needed to be used up, we decided to spend it together. We had the car, so the world was our oyster. We chose to go to Salisbury, so after work one Friday, we put our cases in the back of the car and set off. It was the longest continuous drive that I had so far undertaken, but by now I loved driving so much that I was not daunted by that. It was a lovely summer's evening, and the roads, once we left the London area, were free from traffic and good. Gradually, dusk fell, and I remember the feeling of excitement as we drove over the rolling hills and seeing the approaching towns in front of us. We eventually arrived in Salisbury and started to look for somewhere to stay. The first hotel we tried was full, but on the outskirts of the city we found a small hotel that had chalets to let. These were in the grounds at the back of the hotel. And as it was warm, the idea of sleeping out in a chalet fascinated us, so we happily booked in for a night that we required. We parked Joe in the hotel car park, and for safety's sake, I always took out the rotor arm. I was taking no chances. Joe was very precious to me. Then we traipsed out to our chalet. It was rather like sleeping out in a summer house. There were two beds, a couple of chairs, and a chest of drawers, and it all looked extremely clean and nice. We decided to put our things out ready for bed before going in for our meal. As I drew the curtains together, so the lot fell down around my ears. We soon had them up again. Then Joan found a large beetle lying in the middle of her bed. Fortunately, we were not the people to have hysterics at the sight of insects, but we were pleasantly surprised to find that our beds did not give way when we eventually climbed into them. The next day, we wandered round Salisbury and stopped to have a mid-morning coffee. Joan was delighted to find a small jug of cream on the table, still a relatively rare occurrence since the end of the war. So while we awaited for our coffee to appear, she happily lit up a cigarette after placing it in a cigarette holder that she always used, in pleasant anticipation. As soon as the coffee arrived, she poured some of the cream into her cup. But as she did so, there was the unmistakable smell of vinegar. The cream was in fact salad cream. Later that day, we decided to have a look at Stonehenge, and then drive around the nearby countryside to have a look at the wonderful views. There was a large military camp on the plain, and as we passed, a young soldier raised his hand, so I stopped. He was obviously wanting a lift. After a hurried consultation between Joan and myself, We both felt that we outnumbered him in case of trouble. The near side rear door couldn't be opened from the inside, so I indicated to him to open it himself, which he seemed loath to do. But after much gesticulating, he came round to see me and said that he was on sentry duty and was only waving us on. So much for our good deed. He must have thought that he was being abducted. And later that afternoon, we came to some crossroads where there seemed to be some troop manoeuvres, and there was a very large Churchill tank approaching at the right angles to us from one of the side roads, so I stopped. But the soldier on point duty signalled me forward, so I drove slowly on, and to my horror, so did the tank. We both ground to a halt very dramatically. When I asked the lad on point duty what he was doing, he said that he only wanted me to pull forward a little way. But it made a lot of difference now that I had my own transport, and neither the early start or the late evenings were so much of a bind as they used to be. During the time that I was at Nestles, there was a transport strike. Having my own car, I was not affected, but it made it very difficult getting to work for a lot of people. And for those living out at West Drayton, there was a very novel transport arrangement for them. The factory was on the canal and had a wharf. In days gone by, a lot of the products had come down the canal. But as far as Nestles was concerned, this had now ceased. But the wharf still remained. So for those employees who lived within easy reach of the canal, it was arranged that a narrow boat would call at various points, returning in the evening. This went down very well, and a lot of people were quite sorry when things returned to normal. One day, I was travelling home from work, and I had just come up to the large road junction where I turned left onto the busy Uxbridge Road, when for no apparent reason, Joe stopped, and no way could he be persuaded to start again. The engine was still a collection of mysteries to me, so the only thing I could do was to leave the car and get some help from the nearest garage. Fortunately, I didn't have far to walk, and a mechanic obligingly came back with me. After a short time, when he undid things and put them together again, he found that one of the electrical leads had come adrift. So, with that attached again, Joe burst into life, and with a light heart, I set off for home. And although the car went well, there was an odd noise, which seemed worse when I changed gear. But I arrived home without further trouble. But the noise continued, and it worried me. So I decided after tea to pop down to the local Blue Star garage at Money Hill Parade, just outside Rickey. I knew that it would be open, and I needed some petrol anyway. So off I went. And when I filled up with petrol, I asked the attendant if he could give me any advice about the noise. But he said that he himself didn't know anything about engines, but one of the mechanics was still on the premises, and although not on duty, he was sure that he wouldn't mind having a look at the car. Mick appeared, covered in grease, as he was working on his own car. I explained about the noise, so he said that the only thing to do was to drive it up the road a little way. We hadn't gone far when the noise came again, and Mick knew what it was straight away. Something was obviously loose. But what? That was soon revealed when he opened the bonnet. The air filter was in two parts. The mechanic who had come to my aid earlier had taken it apart in his exploratory going over and had forgotten to put it together again. So he soon had that fixed. Mick offered to lend me a book called The Art of Good Driving, and if I was interested, to drop in the next day, and it would be there for me. This I did. I often called in there anyway to get my petrol, as the garage was on my way home from work. I didn't see Mick again, but one of the other mechanics, an old chap called Bert, was serving me with petrol one day, and, in talking about the car, said that I really should get it serviced regularly, as I did 1,000 miles a month, and on that score, I should have it serviced once a month. I felt that he was right. I certainly didn't do any maintenance myself, so I agreed. It was all very well organised. I was given a little booklet into which was entered the jobs done at each service. It had my name and address on the front. I didn't realise at the time that it was all a put-up job by Bert on Mick's behalf. And after a few regular visits with the car, I got to know Mick, who eventually asked me out. Our first date was to a motorcycle race meeting at Silverstone. It was mid-April, so probably one of the first meetings of the year. Mick called for me at 6:30 in the morning in his old Riley. It was a lovely, typical April day, bright with the sun, beginning to get a bit of warmth in it. His friend, Peter Knocker, also came with us, but he was on his motorcycle, which he was entering into the races. Peter competed, and Mick was his mechanic. Peter had been a friend of Mick's since early school days, and they were both car and motorcycle enthusiasts. We were bowling along the country roads quite happily when suddenly the clutch mechanism in the Riley fell apart. To a lesser man, that would have been catastrophic. But Mick was able to convey our problem to Peter, and we continued on our way, Peter going ahead to prepare the way, because so long as we didn't have to stop, we were able to reach our destination without too much trouble. And a policeman on point duty, near the racing track, waved us through, and we went straight in at the entrance gates, eventually arriving where Mick and Peter intended to park. I don't remember much about the day, except that I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd never been to a race meeting before, and so found it very exciting. There was so much going on, and the noise and the smell of the machines added to the enjoyment. In between keeping an eye on Peter's bike, Mick did a hasty repair job on the Riley, and we motored home without any trouble. Mick took me back to his house in Northwood Hills, where he lived with his aunt, Helen, and his grandmother, Moz. Mick's parents had moved from Wembley, where they had lived, and moved down to Kent, and were now living in a small village just outside Herne Bay called Beltinge. Mick didn't want to go down there, so he had moved in with Helen and Moz. They lived in a small flat in a quiet cul-de-sac, Windsor Close. I liked them both immediately. They were such friendly people. We stopped for a quick cup of tea, then we escorted Peter back to Wembley, where he lived, before going back to my home. And after that first date, we started going out on a regular basis. More often than not, we would go out into the surrounding countryside to seek out quaint little pubs where we could go for a quiet drink and a chat. We gradually found our favourites, one being the Rose and Crown near Harefield. We would take it in turns as to whose car we would go in. And by now, Mick had sold the Riley, and we had an old Ford van into which he had put windows. At the weekends, I would sometimes go over to Northwood Hills for tea, or Mick would come over to us. But I think that he often found our family gatherings a bit overwhelming, as everyone tended to talk over everyone else, and there was a general hubbub of noise. And after going out for a few weeks, Mick was keen for me to meet his parents. His mother, who was always known as Chick, and his father, the old boy. Chick was Helen's sister, so we set off one Saturday to spend the day with them. I expect they were as much on tenterhooks as I was, but again, I liked them both immediately, and we all got on very well. And after that initial visit, we would pop down to see them at quite regular intervals, but going for weekends as the journey was quite long and complicated, negotiating the intricate South Circular route added quite a bit of time to the trip. And going just for one day made one feel as if the entire day was spent getting down there and coming back. And besides meeting Chick and the old boy, Mick also introduced me to a couple of friends and their wives, Don and Joan Carter. Mick had worked with Don when he worked at de Havilland's, and although he had left the firm some time ago, he kept up his friendship with them. In fact, he was the best man at Don and Joan's wedding the year before. And Don and Joan lived in a flat in St. Albans, and John and Edna lived in a basement flat in Watford. So besides our pub forays, we would often meet up with one or two of our friends and spend the evening with them. Sometimes we would just spend the evening at the flat with Helen and Moz, and very often Peter would be over there as well, and also Tony Arrowsmith, who, like Peter, was an old childhood friend. And the three of them spent many happy hours together in Mick's shed at the bottom of the garden, tinkering over one or other of the many machines that they owned between them. Mick had been apprenticed at de Havilland's and, after completing his time there, had stayed with the firm for a while. But the wanderlust had set him roaming, and he'd done quite a lot of different things, eventually ending up at the Blue Star Garage where I met him. But the lure of the aircraft industry was never very far away, and he decided to apply for a job at Fairey Aviation at Hayes. He was accepted for the post and very happily gave in his notice to the garage. But he didn't realise until the morning he started that the 8 o'clock start was only for the first day. Starting time was in fact 7:15. With a good half hour's journey before the start meant a very early rising. I wonder if he had taken the job if he had known beforehand. It was about this time that Roger, Mum's brother, and I went down to Cosham to stay with Auntie Kay for the weekend. And that was the first time that I'd driven down there. We came back early on Sunday afternoon after a very enjoyable weekend. But there'd been quite a lot of rain, and the roads were wet. As we went up Portsdown Hill, the car suddenly went out of control, and after a lot of frantic steering action, the car ended up with its nose in the chalk bank. Roger and I leapt out, and without saying a word to each other, we both looked at the four wheels, for it felt as if one had blown. But they were all intact. A coach travelling down in the opposite direction stopped, and the driver came over to see if he could help, but apart from getting the car back on the road and facing in the right direction, there was nothing he could do. But he suggested that I seek some expert help, as I had a long journey ahead of me. I was a member of the AA, and in those days there were far more of their men cruising around the roads on motorbikes looking for stranded motorists than they are today. So when one hove into sight, I signalled him down and told him about our little upset. He had a perfunctory look around the car and said that as far as he could see, there was nothing amiss, but advised me to call at a garage when we reached Petersfield. He also added that he didn't envy my journey ahead of me, which I thought was quite jolly of him. We took his advice and dropped into the first garage that was open. While they looked it over, Roger and I found a cafe and had a welcome cup of tea. The garage mechanics couldn't find anything wrong either, so very cautiously we set off and completed the trip without further trouble. We'd come to the conclusion that I might have gone into a skid, what with the wet roads and the chalk that crumbled off roadside banks, giving the slippery surface, and I had just overcorrected. Beside Mick's own car and motorbikes that he had to attend to, he also took Joe under his wing. And one big job that needed doing every so often was decoking the engine, a chore that's unknown today, but years ago, when the petrol was not as clean as it is today, the engine would gradually get covered in a layer of encrusted coal-like deposit that had to be chipped off, and the valves ground in again. It was a long, messy job. And I remember sitting out in our garage while Mick had the engine in pieces, trying to help him as much as possible. He also put a heater in the car for me, and he was forever having to mend the arm trafficators that were still used in those days and were perpetually going wrong. In the early spring, we decided to get engaged and planned to get married in early September. Being very prudent, that time of the year was always considered to be the best time as far as income tax rebate was concerned. And like most young couples, that had to be a major consideration. Mick liked the idea of a honeymoon on the Broads, and I was equally happy with the idea. Anything different always appealed to me. We went up to Blake's, the large booking agents for the Broads, and booked a small sailing boat called the Whippet for 2 weeks, starting on the 3rd of September. Now we felt that we should go and see the vicar at St. Mary's Church in Rickmansworth to get that side of the thing sorted out. We started going to church on Sunday evenings, and we liked the vicar very much, the Reverend Frederick Hart. We made an appointment to see him at his rambling old vicarage in Church Street, and found him just as nice face to face as he sounded in the pulpit. We explained the reason for our visit, and that we had planned to get married on the 3rd of September. But to our disbelief, he said that he couldn't perform the ceremony on that day, as he had a prior engagement, a family wedding that he was attending down in Sussex. We pointed out that we couldn't alter the day, as we had already booked the boat, and he jokingly suggested that we might have the wedding after the honeymoon. But he did say that if we were prepared to have the ceremony at 8 o'clock in the morning, he would be quite happy to officiate. We could see no objections to that, and so that was happily settled. And we'll pick up this story again next week. This is the Narrowboat Erica, signing off for the night and wishing you a very restful and peaceful night. Good night. Temperature outside, -0.8 degrees. Inside, 22 degrees. Humidity, 96%. Dew point, -1 degrees. Wind direction, north. Wind strength, 4 miles per hour. Barometric pressure, 1012.5, rising. Cloud cover, fog. Precipitation, nil. Moon phase, 79.5%, waning gibbous. Day length, 8 hours 5 minutes. Sunset, 15:58. Sky casting, 7:55.